Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael LaMagna. Today, I'm joined by the author of Refocusing Academic Libraries Through Learning and Discourse, The Idea of a Library, published in 2023 by Chandos Publishing. Libraries and library professionals have always had to adapt to the changing information landscape created by new technology. With the pandemic requiring a move to fully remote learning, changing natures in how students and users are accessing information, and the introduction of generative AI, along with continued declining budgets, we are at a time when libraries should reconsider their organizational structure. Joining me to discuss this book is author Mary Kay Bolin, Professor Emeritus at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and currently full-time lecturer at the School of Information at San Jose State University. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Thanks, Michael. I appreciate it. Thanks very much for having me on here.
So before we discuss your book, Refocusing Academic Libraries Through Learning and Discourse, I was hoping you'd tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and your path into academic librarianship.
Oh, thank you. That's a very good question. I've worked briefly. I live here in Lincoln, Nebraska. And in the 70s, my very first job was as a page or shelver in the downtown public library here in Lincoln. I started on the day Nixon left office, August 9th, 1974. I was 19 years old. So that's the beginning of my brilliant career. So I worked there. Then I went and I was a student employee at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, which was my school. I was going to school there. I worked there for a couple of years. Then I graduated from college, got a full-time job back at the public library again. Then I got another full-time staff job at the university library. So finally, in 1979, I decided I wanted to have a career in librarianship. I was working in the cataloging department, and someone there said to me, well, if you want to be a cataloger, you should go to the University of Kentucky, because there's this amazing cataloging teacher there. And that was Lois Mai Chan. And I did apply to Kentucky, and I got an assistantship, and I was her assistant. And she was a prolific writer. She wrote a number of cataloging texts. And she, you know, she died at the too young age of 80, 10 years ago, but she was publishing things all through her life, long after retirement. So I did go to Kentucky and I met my husband there. And after library school, there was no doubt that we both wanted to be in academic libraries. And so I wanted to be a cataloger. I went to the University of Georgia. And we were there for 5 years. I was a monographic cataloger, but then I became a supervisor because that was right when AACR2 was being implemented. And they had a giant card catalog. So we had to impose this really kind of radical new code on the card catalog. And it took a lot of taking out a bunch of cards, using the whiteout on there, using the electric eraser, don't wear a hole in the card. It's very easy to do. So all that kind of old card catalog skills and tricks and practices and whatever. After about 5 years, I was happy there at Georgia, and we'd had our first kid. He was 2 years old. I was saying, I want to be ahead of cataloging. I think I'm ready. I want to be ahead of cataloging. And so we ended up going to the University of Idaho. And so, of course, we always say we moved from Athens to Moscow, you know, and we loved Idaho. We stayed there for 17 years. And then we had a miraculous opportunity. And Bob's a librarian, too. And so we were both working in Idaho. In 2003, the chair of technical services at Nebraska came open. And so I applied for it. And then it was like, here is a silver platter with everything you would ever want on it. We'll hire you. We'll hire your husband. We'll hire you both with tenure at your current ranks that you had. So it was like, okay. And at the time, my mom was still alive. All three of my brothers lived here in Lincoln. So it was just, I mean, it was great. We had two more kids by then. So, and meanwhile, at Idaho, Georgia, they were faculty, but kind of faculty in name only. It wasn't, there were some benefits and privileges, but not too many. At Idaho, they had rank and tenure. They participated in university committees. And of course, librarians are always the backbone of that faculty committee structure. So I got to know faculty all across campus. I served in the faculty senate. I served on committees with them. And I started to understand about how do universities work. You know, there were things I knew nothing about, like how does the budget get put together? What about institutional research? What is that? What is accreditation? How do you do that? And so on. So then when I came back to Nebraska, they also have a very strong, excellent model of faculty status. And so I did many of the same things. I was on different committees. I got to know teaching faculty and so on. And I continued working at Nebraska after I got a PhD in 2007 in higher education here at Nebraska. And San Jose the next year wrote to me and said, would you like to be a part-time faculty member for us? And I certainly did want to. And I wrote back to them and they hired me they have many part-time instructors in their very big online program. And so I started off teaching their information retrieval core course. Yeah. And soon after that, they asked me to also please teach the metadata seminar, which I've been doing ever since. Then they had a death in which a cataloging instructor who'd been there a long time, I mean, he died very suddenly. And they asked me to take over teaching cataloging. And I'm not the only cataloging teacher. There are two or three others. But anyway, so since 2013, I've been teaching. At one time, I kind of had two full-time jobs. Then the pandemic came along. Then I went home and I never came back because there was a retirement buyout. And so I was like, well, I'm going to be 65. Sure, you can pay me to go away. I'll do it, you know. And so the pandemic happened and I started working from home. And then the next July, I went and packed up my office. And then, meanwhile, at some point, I'd become a full-time, I guess when I took over the cataloging teaching, I became a full-time lecturer at San Jose. So I'm not a tenure-track faculty there, but I am a full-time lecturer. And I mean, and it's an amazing place. It's a wonderful institution. Everybody I work with is just awesome. The director of the School of Information, Anthony Chow, is just amazing. Sandy Hirsch, our associate dean, who's a former director, fabulous. All the faculty I've met are just absolutely amazing. So my path into academic libraries is really that, you know, if I just kept working at the public library, I can't quite imagine that. It was good, but it wasn't exactly my kind of environment ultimately. And working in the university library made me say, like, I think I'll just go be a librarian, I think. And then they were like, you want to be a cataloger? And I was like, yes, I do. Definitely I do. And then that I would be Lois Chan's assistant. That was a tremendous gift to me. I mean, she was an awesome person. She was a wonderful teacher and a wonderful person. And just such a great scholar and thinker and leader. I also, over the years, the University of Georgia didn't have a publication required for faculty. I did actually have one collaborative publication there. When I got to Idaho, though, it was like, okay, you got 5 years, and that I needed to start having publications. You know, I did. I mean, I know that there are people who fight the idea of faculty status. They find themselves in a tenure track position and they don't really want to be there. They don't like the idea. They don't want to do it. And in my view, they're doing themselves a disservice because it's the best. It's what we should have. And it's the best. And if we can just be engaged in it and maintain it, it's so good for us. So,
I could see how being a faculty member maybe sparked your interest in organizational structures of Absolutely. Academic libraries and institutions. So is that experience what drove you to writing this book?
Ultimately, yes, because the other thing I've studied a lot is linguistics. My undergraduate major was linguistics. at Idaho, you had to have a second master's or a PhD to get promoted to full professor. And of course, I was against that until I got a second master's. And then I was like, it's actually quite a wise idea that I feel that we should all do, you know. And in my second master's, all what I studied was linguistics, the thesis and all the coursework were in linguistics. And there were wonderful faculty there who were really, really awesome linguistics scholars. So I did, you know, I did that. Then I started working on a PhD. And in my PhD work, I was able to combine linguistic analysis with, you know, other kinds of quantitative and slightly qualitative analysis as well. And what I started to become interested in, too, is land-grant universities. I'm very interested in the 1862 land-grants, the ones that are from the 1862, the Morrill Land-Grant Act of 1862. So there's one in each state. And Nebraska is the flagship and the land-grant, which is about 50-50 that it's like that. You know, Kansas State, but Idaho, Georgia, and Nebraska, the land-grant and the flagship are the same. So it did spark my interest, plus which I was a supervisor early on in my career, and then I was a department head and a department chair. We were always talking about who should report to who and what should we call that and how about we split this department and put these two together and how's that going to work? And let's flatten it. Let's, you know, let's unflatten it. So I became very, very, very interested in that. And for my dissertation, I studied the status and appointments of librarians at land-grant universities. So like, are they faculty? If they are, do they have tenure? Do they have rank? Is their chief administrator called a dean? And does that make any difference? And various other parameters like that. And then I did a discourse analysis of appointment documents. So it was like criteria for the appointment to the rank of associate professor or whatever. And so I had documents and I did this kind of analysis that I really got hooked on, which I did. I've done it in both of my books and I did it in my dissertation. And that's called field tenor mode genre register, FTMGR, as we say. There's a scholar named Michael Halliday, who's an Australian linguist, and he is kind of the father of functional grammar, which is, it's a kind of discourse analysis-based grammar because it's based in use. And so field is, what is the text about? Tenor is, who are the participants? Mode is, what makes a text? And then the genre is it a recognizable genre? And therefore, every genre has a register, which is what is the language type that is used in this register. And I found very, very fascinating things about that, which is I did identify, and I'm sure I'm certainly not the first person that ever did this, a genre that I called appointment documents. So they're like vacancy announcements, criteria for promotion, criteria for tenure, even evaluation documents could be it. But I really easily found on the web documents for each of these 50 schools that I looked at. Mm-hmm. And I selected typical ones. I created a typology, which was type 1, 2, 3, and 4. One is the best, in my opinion. That is faculty status with rank and tenure. Mm-hmm. Two is similar. Three is, you know, the University of Georgia is a type 3, for example, meaning no rank, no tenure, some benefits. And 4, which means not faculty but staff. Mm-hmm. And it is not a judgment on these types. University of California system, for example, they are not, people librarians there are not faculty, they're staff, but it's like it's the strongest staff model you'll ever see. You know, it's so equivalent to faculty status in so many ways. Anyway, I see that I'm going off on a tangent, so let's see. Where was I?
Let's bring it back because, you were talking about organizational structures and I really like that. And I know many librarians can relate to how you opened your book where you described the bureaucratic organizational structures as libraries as iron cages, right?
Yes.
And frustration that many feel in that structure. So seriously, how do structures like that develop in libraries?
Well, I mean, my boyfriend, Max Weber, he's the one who, you know, he developed that theory of bureaucracy, including the iron cage. And apparently in German, it's like Stahlharte Shell, meaning like the steel shell, like a bug would have or something, like a carcass or, whatever. But his thing was that organizations become, if you have an organization, it grows to a little bit of size, you start having structuration. You can't just all, you have to. And the structure emerges from that. And it might be the most perfect, wonderful structure on earth, but it's going to become a cage pretty soon because of people that are involved, the situation, the money situation, whatever, the process you use to develop it. So for me, that iron cage metaphor is so powerful. And the other thing in my first book, I discovered the concept of institutionalism and the many different kinds of institutionalism. And there's this famous article, I should be able to say it right off the top of my head. Who were these two guys? 1983. DiMaggio and Powell, 1983. Institutional isomorphism and structural conformity. And in fact, they also wrote The Iron Cage Revisited, Institutional Isomorphism and Collective Rationality in Organizational Fields. That may be the very famous article that's been cited by just everyone. Mm-hmm. In it, they talk about different kinds of isomorphism, meaning how institutions imitate each other and they become more like each other. You go to ALA and it's like, hey, they've got a thing that now and we should have that thing too. And then you're like, okay, we have it. And they divide, can I name them? Mimetic isomorphism is the kind we're most familiar with, where it's like, Ohio State did that, so I think we should do that too, because we want to be like them. There was also, I can't remember the other three kinds, but there were three other kinds that were similar. I think some of them were the institution imposes it. Mm-hmm. The chancellor's office says we have to have this. So we're gonna do that. And there were two other kinds that were similar, but anyway, it was the forces that shape this isomorphism, both internally and externally. So I became really fascinated with that. And again, where was I?
So I think many of us in higher education probably can identify with the idea of the corporatization of academic library structures as well as institutions of higher education as a whole. So I was wondering if you could kind of discuss the current typical structure of an academic library and where the librarians and the library staff fit in, because we could see there's a lot of mimicking that goes on. Oh, this institution structured that way. So how do libraries kind of structure themselves?
Well, okay. So it's my linguistic background. It's also my cataloging background. I do like to sort things and make typologies, see what patterns merge. So in my dissertation, I had the four types of librarian status. In my first book, which was called The 21st Century Academic Library, Global Patterns of Organization and Discourse, that came out in 2017. Mm-hmm. I surveyed, by the web, libraries in the Anglophone world. So it was North America, Anglophone Europe, Anglophone Africa, South Asia, and so on. And I looked at their websites to see what I could see about their organizational pattern. And I found, again, types 1, 2, 3, and 4. Type one, I called traditional. That might not be quite the word I used, but anyway. The second one was, let me go here. The fourth one was refocused. Mm-hmm. The third one was like transitioning. The second one was just somewhere between traditional and transitioning. And what I found was the most libraries in the population still have the traditional organization, in which it's book comes in, acquisitions, book comes in, book is here, book goes cataloging, book goes here, you know, book to circulation, reference helps give access to it, instruction, all those things. It was just like, it was all built around the journey of a book, a print item. Mm-hmm. In these refocused libraries, which I found universal really in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and a few other places, the library was organized around teaching and learning. That was the central metaphor or paradigm. And I really still want to explore that refocused type more. That's kind of what I set out to do in the second book, but I just went off in a different direction. That was also interesting to me. Because what I really want to see is, it's like, okay, you say it's organized around teaching and learning, but is it really just reference, cataloging, circulation? Do you just call them something different, or is it truly a new organizing principle that would give you a lot more freedom? Because, a lot of decisions have been driven by stuff like, we only use these one vendors. We only use these vendors. They use this technology. Therefore, we have to do it this way. Mm-hmm. Right down to the spine labels, you know, like how we get that kind of stuff. So let's see. I'm meeting myself coming and going as usual.
It's interesting as we think about refocusing academic libraries today as we're coming out of the pandemic. There's a changing landscape, and to think about it in terms of teaching and learning versus these more siloed organizational structures around the processing of a book, right?
So we all need to buy into that, where it's like, yes, cataloging is where my heart is. It's the one thing I'm, if I were going to go back to a library now, I'd just be like, let me do cataloging, because that's what I love doing. And that's what I teach. So, you know, I'm still very interested in it. But can we free ourselves from the iron cage, mm-hmm. where people will still do cataloging? But I mean, if we really freed ourselves from that, we would stop thinking about, here's a book, look it up, do this, do that. Could we think more globally? Because nowadays, far more collections have MARC records with them. So it's like, it's not a one at a time kind of thing anymore. If we could free ourselves from that. And so in my second book, in my newer book, the thing I really wanted to try to think of was, what's the process for refocusing? How can we refocus? Mm-hmm. And I've been very interested in things like models like the learning organization. The University of Nebraska adopted that more than 20 years ago, the University of Nebraska Library. And I always felt like we could have done more with it. Like, it wasn't internalized as much as one would hope, that people didn't talk about it. People didn't say, well, this year I'm going to try to work on mental models, or, you know, whatever. And that we would truly do that. And I do think those learning organization disciplines are so powerful, mm-hmm. that it was a helpful structure for the book to be like, how can these be put into place? Because thinking about the process, one barrier to that I always feel is, first of all, we allow unengaged and toxic people to have their way and run things and ruin everything. Mm-hmm. We allow people not to participate. We allow them to crab about it and complain about it. But it's like, put up or shut up. Ever heard that? You know, seriously. And I mean, it's like, complain all you want, talk all you want, be, you know, feel free to criticize. I mean, everyone does that, and we all should do that. But just to be like, no, it's a bad idea, it's a stupid idea, I hate it, but I'm not going to tell you my ideas, no. So part of my goal was to say, how to get everyone involved. Mm-hmm. I also feel, I looked at it again today, and I felt differently about it. But when I first did the literature review, I sort of felt like, this is kind of crazy. I've kind of gone crazy here. I amassed a gigantic amount of literature about DEI in the workplace, mm-hmm. and about the need. Like, you cannot have this process. You cannot refocus unless you get everybody involved. You can't get everyone involved unless you accept everyone. Right. And that includes, you know, gender, race, sexuality. And I really think neurodiversity is the undiscovered thing in libraries. There are so many neurodiverse people in libraries. Mm-hmm. It's you know, and in the teaching departments too, of course. But we don't acknowledge it. In fact, we sort of we make those people into problem employees. It's like, yeah, they're brilliant, but they annoyed me or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't just say, yes, okay, but we accept ourselves, we accept others. We know that we're all strange. And so when I looked at my literature again today, I was saying, no, this is actually, I'm actually pretty interested in this, which I am, you know.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Because I don't even think libraries have made, I don't think they've made in many places the kind of process in racial equality and, you know, other things like that, librarians of color and so on, as we could have, and not even gender equality. Mm-hmm. And I think female dominated profession. Yes. And I don't even mean like many, many, many libraries administrators are women now. So I'm not even just saying it in that simplistic sort of way. But I think that to create a really good organization, everybody has to feel like they're part of it. And it can be like, you know, I myself am not a neurotypical person. I'm just not. No one in my family is. So I've always had harmonious working relationships. I haven't found it hard to get a job or keep a job, but I don't think like most of the people. I think differently than most of my colleagues, like than many of them. The way mm-hmm. And part of it is that I'm in love with ideas. And that's what I wanted to say, the idea of a library. What is the idea of a library? That's where it starts, right?
Yeah.
Because we had a lot of Sturm und Drang over the last 20 years about collections and, you know, having it not in, you know, having compact storage, remote storage. And people wanted to get into a discussion of what should a library be. And it was like, I know you want to talk about that, but not in a way that's fruitful. It was more like grinding a little axe about something, you know? So the idea of a library is important.
Yeah.
Organizations are people, you know, corporations mm-hmm. are not people, but organizations are people. So I just think that's where it has to start. What's your idea? It's a mm-hmm. group of people doing what, and what are we doing?
And so you mentioned earlier that you were using a discourse analysis methodology for this work. And yeah. so you went ahead and you looked at some strategic plans. So
yes.
Which strategic plans did you look at? How did you select them? And what did you find from your analysis?
Well, the M.A.K. Halliday, his technique says, choose one long, single, typical text. And I may be actually, maybe another scholar who said that, but in different kinds of text and discourse analysis, that's the, you know, choose one long, single, typical text. So in doing my dissertation, for example, I chose schools like University of Illinois. They're a very typical big land grant with good faculty status, what I consider good. Mm-hmm. So for the strategic plans, I went back through my dissertation documents and what I tried to do was find, I'm not even sure if I ended up doing this, but I picked one from each type. And I think I picked one from each type of librarian status and one from each type of organizational type. So, you know, a refocused library, you know, and the refocused one, I think it's actually a library in Australia. I think it's Queensland University of Technology. Mm-hmm. And the way I did it was to, first of all, the field tenor mode analysis. What is this text about? Who are the participants in this text and what is their relationship? What is the power differential? Because there is also critical discourse analysis, which analyzes these power relationships in texts. And what I found, certainly in my dissertation, I found this, but I found it in every other time I've done this too. Libraries and universities tend to use the HR register when they're talking about things. They don't really use any highfalutin, beautiful conceptual language. It's really much more, you know, it's got an authoritarian side and it expresses this hierarchical, the university requires that you do X, Y, and Z. So again, with these strategic plans, I did find a lot of that HR language in there, but I also found aspirational things, conceptual and aspirational things that were really very good. Whether we get too bogged down in the daily details and we never really get to them, I don't know. But I certainly did find that too. Another very strong characteristic of this register of speech is this series of three adjectives, nouns, or verbs. So, and we do it very deliberately. You've probably been in the room with the flip chart where they're saying like we educate something and something. You know, we provide, we instruct, we educate, we teach. And that just, it's just, those are just ubiquitous everywhere. And they can give a real redundant, repetitive. On the other hand, in Halliday's work, he and his wife, who's also a linguist, wrote this brilliant book called Cohesion in English. And it tells the cohesive devices that make a text a text. And those mm-hmm. include repetition, referring back to something previously, even the use of pronouns is a cohesive device. And so I analyzed that as well, and I found very interesting things about that. So, the basic thing that I found is that I wanted to identify, do I see a genre here? And what register or registers does this genre use? Because they do use librarian, the language of librarianship, the language of academia in general, the language of higher education, but this HR presence. And I'm not being pejorative to people in human resources because they've been very helpful to me over the years. But it does have a very bureaucratic and sometimes authoritarian and, you know, legalistic aspect to it.
So with that finding, how should we start to refocus an academic library so that we can focus on being a learning organization?
So my book tries to set out an actual process. I have some examples even of like, what method would you do to, we've done this a million times before where it's like, here's a survey, fill this out. Here's a flip chart, write some stuff on here. Now you compile those notes. And then most of the time, nothing happens. Yeah. If something does happen, steps one through three happen, but the rest don't happen or whatever. We mostly don't hear of it again. And I'm not even criticizing anyone for that. I know why that is. It's because we all have so many other things to do. Mm-hmm. And something intervenes. Nope, sorry, time to do the budget. Nope, evaluation time. So I would say the first thing is to bring everybody in. Bring them all up to speed. If you're going to use the learning organization as a model, you really have to get everybody up to speed on that so they can name the five disciplines. They know how they apply to their own work. They're looking at the organization in that way. Group learning, it's the best thing ever. Systems thinking, mm-hmm. all those things are so powerful. And when it's presented in a kind of half-hearted way, people, they see through that and they don't think it means anything to them. They don't think they're ever going to do anything with it. And so on. So I feel like first you got to cast the net, get everyone in. And in some way that is not authoritarian, everyone has to participate. And I don't know what the incentive for that is. And I don't propose any kind of penalty or punishment for not participating, but I just like somehow I would like to help make people want to participate. Mm-hmm. The hardest thing that I've seen over the years for all this kind of endeavors is that people are afraid. And I've been in organizations where I know why they were afraid. There was somebody in having power that I was afraid of them too. You know, like they just were, it was not a safe space. It was not a safe environment. Over the years, I've worked with people who've said, we want people to take risks. And it's like, well, you take them to the guillotine if they take a risk and it doesn't turn out. We want to try things and have them fail. It's like, no, you don't. I've heard that one, but no. So first of all, to me, it would be, and I think it'd be open about some stuff where, and of course, there's confidentiality and stuff, but it's like, I worked with a person long ago in the past that people used to complain about. And if I had been able to say, well, that person is on the autism spectrum. And so, yes, they may act differently than some other people. I was not at liberty to say that. I mean, I didn't even know it. I was really just surmising it. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, it's like, if we could all know and accept and be honest about who we are and to understand, you know, yes, if somebody is LGBTQ, if they're a person of color, they have had experiences that people who aren't in that category, they just don't know. They weren't there. They don't know about it. They haven't experienced it. So I think it's the inclusiveness maybe is the first thing. And the other kind of model I used were these core competencies that many people have. Inclusiveness is one of them. And I feel like inclusiveness, that's where some people get punished, where it was like, well, she didn't say hello to me. And it's like, well, maybe she did or maybe she didn't, but whatever. That's not what inclusiveness means. I mean, it could be, but it's not. That's not what we're talking about. It's a much broader sort of concept than that. So I feel like it starts there with that common understanding. And, you know, I don't literally know what is the thing that's going to do the trick, because we've all been to a million workshops, seminars, trainings, you know, different stuff like that. And the thing I felt over the years is, you know, Lily Tomlin's character, Edith Ann, says, I'm not bossy. My ideas is just better. And that's what I feel. My ideas is just better. I'm not bossy. People don't want to talk about ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's time for practical things. I agree. And I can get right down to the practical details, but the ideas first.
Yeah. And it seems if we're looking to create an inclusive learning environment for our students, as we have a more diverse student population, wouldn't we want that on the staff as we're discussing these ideas? So what should some of the ground rules be for engaging in this process?
I do think somehow, I don't know how to enforce this, but it's got to be starts from the top. We all accept everyone. You know, yes, there are always these feuds and conflicts and toxic people. And I guess it starts in the past. Go back in time and don't hire that person. Go back in time and don't make that person a department chair or whatever. Too late. but I think it's somehow to create the inclusive environment. I feel like, first of all, people have to acknowledge their own characteristics. Like, I try to know myself well, and I know that I go off on a tangent, I talk too much, people find it tiresome sometimes, and I am aware of it. I'm not just like, who, me? I never do that. So to me, the ground rules would have to be everyone participates, and there is a hierarchy in the library, probably still. There is no hierarchy in this process. Mm-hmm. But we have to acknowledge, if I'm given authority, authority and power go together. I have to acknowledge that and say, okay, if I have authority, that means I have the power, I have the potential or power to hurt someone. You know, I can offend someone, I can hurt their feelings, I can make them feel bad, and that's the last thing I ever want to do. But I feel like people haven't necessarily been told, like, okay, you have some authority. It has responsibility, as we know. And just put yourself in someone else's shoes. That kind of is the meaning of the whole literature review of my book, is like, think of it from someone else's point of view. Think of what they felt like when they came to work today. A thing happened once where a person of color was offended by something that someone said to them. And I, in hearing the whole story, felt like, oh, this is pretty minor. I talked to that person's department chair, who was also a person of color, and she and I were friends, and she said to me, just apologize. And I was like, okay, just apologize. That was good advice from her. And it was like, whether this other person was right or wrong, who cares? Just apologize. So I feel like everybody has to be ready to do that, where, I'm sorry, I did offend you, I didn't mean to, I apologize. And not the non-apology either, but it's like, yes, I'm capable of offending people, I've done it, and I'll apologize if I do it. So for everyone to just be like, I'm not perfect. Here's another little small tangent. Libraries are so averse to just going up to someone and saying, can I talk to you for a minute? Let's talk this thing over. No, I'm going to go around and talk to everybody else in the place. I won't tell you at all what the problem that I have. If we could get the atmosphere where it's like, I don't think it's wrong to talk behind people's back. I think it's part of human nature, but it's like, could you just talk to this person instead of, you know, talking to everyone else first before you try to solve the problem with that person? So I guess the other thing is, I would feel like it has to be inclusive. It has to be participative. It has to somehow be in small chunks, where it's not just, here's the grand plan, and in 5 years, we're going to get there. It's like, where are we going to be next month? Mm-hmm. And I do think strategic planning is a skill people have learned, where it's like, yes, it has phases, and we go through the phases and we update these things, and then we have a plan, and then we, you know, we update it again. So anyway, all right. So I'll stop for breath for one moment here.
Yeah. So to touch on that point, I liked how you talked and you discussed the need for an organization to kind of regroup and re-engage and what you called refocusing after a 6 month period. So why did you choose that time frame? And I guess because we could think of it in strategic plans, you're usually 3 to 5 years out. You know, by the time you're getting towards the end of it, you're realizing maybe you didn't do all that you would hope to. So is that 6 months just long enough where you can get started? Or
I do think it's like it's the startup period or something, where you're really, everybody has to be really honest with each other. And somehow you have to prove that, because I know there are a lot of people who you say that, but I don't believe you. And for good reason, they've been burned in the past. So somehow we would have to take some steps to prove, I really mean it when I say you can say anything to me. And I, you know, I I don't always practice what I preach, but as an administrator in this way, I certainly did, because I would say to people, I don't care. You can say anything you want to me. Say it right to my face. I don't care. And I don't. It's fine. Mm-hmm. And I've had people who were good enough to just tell me right to my face, okay, here's a problem. Much better than people just going around grumbling behind my back, you know? So I think that administrators need to prove that they mean what they say. And everyone talks about those two words, transformation and transparency. And I think they're both very difficult, because transparency, I don't know everything that's going on. If I'm a department chair, the dean can't tell me some stuff. She may tell me a lot of things, but there's some stuff she can't tell me. And I don't want her to do that. There's just stuff that, you know, and the transformation to me is kind of I use refocusing, because for me, transformation is, I don't know, it implies some kind of magic, some kind of, you know, instant, I drew a new org chart, here we are, let's be transformed. And I think it's a more organic, it's a slower process than that. So I think it's that thing where it's both fast and slow. Mm-hmm. We want to build something new, but we want the cage to have this door. We just get out anytime we want. Not even a cage, something else, you know. So 6 months to me is just, I mean, you know, there was that joke about how that's a Friedman unit, you know, the guy, Thomas Friedman, it was always going to be 6 months from now, we'll be out of Iraq or whatever. maybe that's a Bolin unit, 6 months. Just because I think it's short enough that people could see some results, mm-hmm. and there'd be some enthusiasm and you would maybe want to participate. You, I think, could identify who are the natural leaders, whether they're in a leadership position or not. Who do people listen to? Who's got the informal power or whatever? And kind of identify those people, help mentor them and foster their leadership ability. Because also to articulate, learning is the highest value in any university and in any library. What else is there? Yeah. And that it's exciting. It's exciting to learn something. Even if it's painful, it's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's one thing I want to touch on. So as you were discussing this unstructured, refocused academic library, you were discussing new paths into the library profession beyond the MLS degree, and that's to go towards this more inclusive environment. That's a theme in your work. And so you suggested subject-specific graduate and doctoral degrees, but you also suggested that libraries should provide professional development funding for staff to obtain their MLS degree if they were interested. So can you tell me what you think the role of the MLS degree in this profession should be moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I know there are many discussions about it. I'm seeing many variations of it. San Jose State is now... They're actually looking at one or more. They have one undergraduate degree, and it's it's in informatics, I believe. But they're looking at different kinds of degrees that are library and information science and allied fields. Nebraska is really strong in digital humanities, and we have a number of library faculty who may not have an MLIS, but they have a PhD in English or history or something, and they're very, very strong in digital humanities and are doing amazing projects in the library and with the English and history departments. Hmm. So I used to be just so rigid and doctrinaire about that. I wouldn't hear of the idea that we would have a library faculty member who didn't have an MLIS. Nebraska, really being at Nebraska, taught me that I was being too narrow-minded about that, because the people I worked with were just so fabulous. And I do strongly feel, though, that especially with the online programs that are available now, we ought to be encouraging staff to get an MLIS, but then we can't just leave them hanging there. It's like, you're a clerk still, but you got this MLIS, get another master's degree, do whatever, you know. We should be supporting them financially and with time, you know, to do that. And also thinking ahead. I mean, as an administrator, I was always planning and scheming about stuff. And you know, that always includes, like, now if so-and-so retires and so-and-so does this and so, you know, just kind of, you know, thinking ahead to what the possibilities might be. Mm-hmm. Succession planning. And to let people know, it's like, if you think we don't talk about these things, of course we do. And you talk about them too. Other people talk about that kind of stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. Yes, we're thinking ahead and we're trying to, you know. And for me, that would give people a chance to, you go to the dean and you say, you know what I'd like to do in the future? And then, okay, plant that seed. And then to enrich the jobs they have as well. So yeah, and you know, the idea of the unstructured library, I really feel libraries will have structure. They should have structure. I just don't want it to be an iron cage. You know, mm-hmm. I just would like it to be more like, couldn't I just talk to the people in that department and maybe we would, you know, whatever. I know that dream of the unstructured teams and the self-managed teams. Maybe at Arizona and other places, maybe it has worked just beautifully. I don't know. When it was introduced, I know everyone, including me, was like, what? And I think it probably was done badly in some places and well in some other places. But yes, to get people to talk to each other and see that, you know, intellectually, I'm a lumper and not a splitter. So I'd rather see how things are similar than be like, no, 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 put that box, you know, get in that box. So
what I really liked is that, you know, you were discussing in your book and really concluding your work talking about the humane workplace.
Yes.
And I think that's such an important theme, especially as we're coming out of the pandemic, as more attention's been placed on workplace culture, work-life balance, and employees are really looking for a more flexible work environment than ever before. So how do we build that into this new refocused academic library?
I'm very interested in the post-pandemic workplace. And, you know, I think we've heard both sides of this where, you know, many employees want the option of working at home or having a hybrid assignment. Administrators and bosses, I think, some of them have been very open to that. Others have just very definitely wanted people to come back to work. And I definitely don't belong to that camp of everybody's got to show up every day and talk to each other or whatever. But I am an introvert and somewhat of a hermit. Staying at home during the pandemic was not a hardship to me whatsoever. And partly that's just because I'm a privileged person. My kids are grown up. I had a job. I had two jobs where I could work remotely. And so we should make it easy for people who need to do that, both in terms of their assignment, the time. Horrible things I heard about keystroke logging and constant monitoring of people. It's like, that trick never works, you know? So I always think it, you know, it comes from within. It starts at the top. It starts with each person to know yourself and accept who you are and try to be better, try to be kind to other people and not just talking about it, you know, actually practicing it. Mm-hmm. And knowing that I fail every day. Everyone fails every day. So to be in more of that kind of environment, we're humane because we fail because we're humans, but also we want the chance to repair and to get better and to be open to tell each other stuff. And so I don't have a magic way to do that. I also have always observed that an insecure administrator is the worst thing for an organization because people like that often tend to be rigid and they just cling to something. They act out, they get offended because they're not secure in the idea that, okay, I'm the boss, doesn't mean I'm the queen, whatever. And other people, I'll leave here someday and somebody else will be the boss. And that, you know, I'm very, very replaceable. So that if everybody could just see themselves in that way, everybody's important, everybody's replaceable, everybody's equal. Mm-hmm. We might have different roles. We might have different responsibilities. But I think partly, I don't know, I never like to get into these faculty and staff discussions about the staff are unhappy because the faculty, there's such a separation. That's a little bit of a trigger for me where I get a little annoyed about it because I feel like certainly that is an issue, but it's not an issue simply that there are some people who are faculty and some people who are staff, you know.
Yeah.
All workplaces have division of labor and different credentialing, different responsibilities, you know. So I don't really know how you create it, but maybe one step at a time, one person, each person starts with each person. And part of the ground rules could be like, I will participate in this. I will do my best. And I acknowledge that I'm a human and I make mistakes and I will listen to constructive criticism and I will give feedback to others as well. I don't know what that is. That's some kind of little, you know, when you make your mission and vision statement that somehow it's the role of each person.
Yeah. So I think we're at an interesting time to really think about how we can refocus academic libraries, given the rise of online learning, this push for a more flexible workplace. It really is an interesting thought process to go through.
Well, so I was born in 1954. There's Gen X, there's millennials, now there's Gen Z. There is almost no generation older than I am. The greatest generation, the silent generation, they're still around. Bob Dylan, all the Beatles, you know, all that. They're getting up in their 80s now. But I'm an old person now, and there's many, many, many younger generations after me. I'm very, very happy to see that millennials and Gen Z are like, no, I'm not doing that. No, I won't have a boss like that. I won't do that. Good for them. That's good that people are waking up to, like, who said it had to be this way? Because I was more indoctrinated into this sort of, like, there's a rule, you get to work at this time, you do this, you do this, you do this. And there was lots of flexibility even in those days. But I do think it is, like, work is part of life. And people should be happy at work. And I don't know why that makes some people uncomfortable to think that work should be fun and should be happy. And, you know, you should like it. It should be something you love. So, you know.
But it definitely should not be a novel idea to enjoy going to work.
Right. And the work is not punishment. It's not. Work is like expressing yourself. Work should be like, it should be expressing yourself, like who you are and what you want to contribute to the world.
Well, Mary, I know we've taken up a lot of your time today. And as we wrap up our time together, I was wondering if you're working on any new projects. Are you going to continue to explore organizational structures of libraries and think about the library of the future? Or are you heading in a new direction with your research?
I still am interested. I'm still very interested in organizational structure. And I really have thought I should do the thing I kind of set out to do, which is look at those type four refocused organizations, look at them more closely, query them in a little different way to see, like, how transformative is it? Is it just a name? Is it, you know, are there subtypes within there? Mm-hmm. Is it more successful? Is it truly more successful than this more traditional kind of assembly line kind of way? And other things people have written on organization just haven't been the thing I'm looking for. There are many interesting and good things written about organization, and the work on institutionalism and isomorphism and so on is very, very useful to libraries. It's been very, very interesting to me. So I do still see myself working on the discourse analysis and genre analysis. I'm still interested in these populations of universities and libraries and how they're organized. And the organization to me, it's like, it's conceptual. It's like, what's the idea? What's the idea of this library? It's got an assembly line, but that's not what it is. You know, it's got a collection, but that's not what it is. I do see myself continuing to work in that way. I actually started a project that didn't get very far, which was I wanted to look at a bunch of university libraries and see what do they call technical services nowadays and what does it include? Because that's where I've always worked. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't get very far with it. And I hadn't quite worked out what was my actual framework for this. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so.
Yeah, those sound like great projects. And I really like the idea of closing the loop on those refocused institutions.
Uh-huh. See to how really see
if the structure paid off.
To see and to see what it really means. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed our conversation, Mary.
Well, thank you. I did too. I had a really fun time. And, you know, as you know, I talk a lot. So and now I'm all wound up. So I'm going to drive my family crazy all day by talking to them. So, you know.
Well, thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Michael Imagna, and thank you for listening to the New Books in Library Science podcast channel on the New Books Network.